so more time to discuss tomorrow. Okay, I'm Nan Yeld. I'm Dean of the Centre for Higher Education at UCT, and I'm also Director of UCT's Confucius Institute, so have a great interest in this subject. In fact, I've just been, as I was saying, up there at Harbin at minus 36, minus 37 degrees centigrade, so this feels quite balmy, you know. So, thank you very much, Russ, for agreeing to do this. Russ is an academic researcher focusing on Africa, on China since about 2005, but actually you lived in China for some years before then, so has a lot of experience. And specializing in nationalism, ethnicity, economic development, and the security implications of China's role in Africa. I'm going to leave it to him to actually, as I said, outline how he's going to run the next 2 days and tell us a little bit more about yourself. But thank you again for agreeing to do this. I think we're in very good hands. And I know that for many of us in South Africa, the whole issue of China and our relations with it are of great interest and concern and promise, good and bad. Okay, over to you, Russ. Thanks very much.
Thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. I've been trained mainly in China and Chinese history. I've only moved in about the last year or so into China-Africa relations. One of the things I've sort of experienced since I've come back here to South Africa is the sense that particularly the knowledge on the Chinese side is lacking. And I think I sort of see it as one of my missions to sort of try and explain to people more about China and how China fits into the whole China-Africa equation, familiarizing people with some of the history, recent history, trying to explain who they are and why they're doing what they're doing and why they seem the way they do and so forth. So in these talks, I will have quite a strong focus on China. I will be constantly relating back to Africa. But I've sort of deliberately taken this route. We will be talking a lot about contemporary China-Africa relations. That will happen in the second half of today's lecture and into tomorrow's lecture. But for the first part of the lecture, I actually want to focus on the history of China and Africa, how Africans started to appear in China, when they started to appear, what was that relationship, and how that feeds in today in terms of diplomacy and whatnot, how the government draws on these on its historical past relations with China in order to forward its aims today. So, like I say, we'll begin with the history bit, and by sort of, I guess, nearing the end of the lecture, we'll start entering contemporary China. You can ask some questions, and then most of tomorrow we'll be focusing on the politics and economics of contemporary China. Okay. So, without any further ado, we'll start. The first engagement with Africans from Chinese people, it's hard to know when exactly it happened, but we know that figures start to appear in about the late Tang Dynasty, about the 9th century. You start seeing African figures in Chinese paintings and sculpture. It's difficult to say when the actual idea of Africans came in, because a lot of dark-skinned people in living around Southeast Asia and stuff were also depicted. Some Aboriginal groups living in Malaysia and whatnot also had similar features. So there was a confusion as to whether these people they were depicting were Africans or from Southeast Asia. But by about ninth century, it was confirmed that in South China, there was the Arabic slave trade, where Arabs were bringing East Africans over, sold them in South China, where they were used as slaves in high-income households. And this is an example from a popular novel of an African slave being bought. This is from the Song Dynasty, representing Tang. This is about 10th, 11th century AD. These are, just to give you an understanding of the sort of imperial Chinese worldview. The Chinese, like many empires at the time, saw themselves as the sort of center of the universe, with civilization radiating out. In fact, they even had a sort of formal model of 5 layers of civilization going out, and at each level, you were sort of less and less civilized. particularly in the Tang Dynasty, a lot of foreigners came into China because it was at the time probably the biggest empire in the world. City of Chang'an was bigger than Rome at the time. We had a lot of foreigners coming in, particularly from we call the Silk Road today. Over there, so probably on the far left, is an Iranian. In the middle, probably someone from Central Asia. And on the right here, this was probably the first depiction of what we understood as an African, what the Chinese used to call the Kunlun. And Kunlun was an African slave. Now, slavery in China at the time was not like the West, where there were huge amounts of slaves shipped in from other parts of the world. The slavery that she had in China was internal mainly. And this example of South China, Guangzhou, was quite unusual in that they had slaves. I'll just read a quick description of someone at the time who's describing African slaves. It says, they are called the wild people. Their colouring is black like ink, their lips are red, their teeth white, their hair is curly and yellowish. They are both females and males. They were born in the mountains beyond the sea. They eat uncooked food. When they are captured, they are fed cooked food, which gives them diarrhea. Those who do not die can be domesticated. Those who have been domesticated for a long time can understand human language, although they cannot speak it themselves. A type of wild man who comes into a place near the sea and who can enter the water without closing his eyes is called a Kunlun slave. So it's the term Kunlun. Now, I mean, today we would think of, well, these are very sort of racist and inappropriate way of describing people of other cultures or whatnot. But I mean, of course, at this period, this is 9th, 10th century, you can imagine in Europe people talked about equally fantastical descriptions of other people. I mean, it is a very common thing in those days. Now, the reason I think I'm emphasizing this aspect of Chinese culture is because when the Chinese state, when it officially likes to talk about its encounters with Africa and China, it likes to begin with a different historical example, and that is, some of you might know, a sailor by the name of Zhang He. Zhang He was, there's a book that was out called 1421, yeah, and it covers Zhang He in there. Zhang He was a eunuch, he was a eunuch Muslim. China has quite a big Muslim population, which incidentally also began from Arab traders bringing people from Arabia region to South China. And he went on a number of trips around Southeast Asia, Arabia, and down into Africa. And this was during the Ming period, which is 1368 to 1644. They have found on the east coast of Africa, because on I think two of his trips he managed to get to East Africa, and on the coast of Somalia, Kenya, I think Tanzania, they found Chinese artifacts dating back to about this period. Now the reason the Chinese today in their official discourse talk about this as the sort of first encounter between Africans and Chinese is because something really crucial happened in this encounter that didn't happen in West encounters with Africa, and that was that they didn't colonize. There was no colonization. There were animals brought back. Apparently, some giraffes were taken back to the emperor, Yongle emperor, who was a great fan of Zhang He's and funded a lot of his trips. This actually, I just put this in for effect. This is actually, I think, painted in Bengal, somewhere in India, of a giraffe that had come from Africa, which they were bringing to the West. So, you know, at a similar time, or slightly later, when Europe started to encounter Africa, it had a much different attitude. Some people say this is where the origins of sort of capitalist economy started. They started extracting resources, colonizing regions, using slave labor and whatnot. So this, as we'll see later as we move on, this becomes very, very crucial in China's charm offensive today in Africa. Was, you know, we were powerful enough to send our fleets overseas just like Westerners were, but, you know, unlike them, we didn't try and make slaves of you and colonize you. As you see from the evidence I just provided earlier, there was actually African slaves in China. It wasn't a very big enterprise, however, it did exist, and it's something that you don't really read about in official accounts for obvious reasons, I guess. Okay. the other interesting thing I might just point out about Zhang He is that people have done research on him, and what's interesting is he was quite an obscure figure in China. Not many people knew about him, and he has no sort of national hero status. It was only 20 years ago that the Chinese government started to beef him up, so to speak, and start presenting him as a sort of national hero who had traveled around the world in the Ming Dynasty in the 14th century. I think this is possibly not so much to do with Africa, but just sort of as China's economy has emerged and it's starting to assert its weight on the world power, asserting its weight in the world scene, it draws on some of its historical precedents to sort of legitimize this. And one other thing I just might mention before we move on to modern China is that sometimes people often ask the question, why didn't China colonize? Why, for instance, in Europe, did you see this massive colonization of most parts of the world, but China didn't do this yet, it had the capacity to do it? Well, one theory is that this is a map of China today, but if you look historically, it's not always looked this way. It's changed its configuration according to different dynasties many, many times. And sort of this area here onwards is and sort of up here is often considered non-Chinese, as we understand as Chinese people. You have Uyghurs, Tibetans, Kazakhs, Mongols, Manchus, all sorts of people who lived in steppe and desert region. And the border between the Chinese civilization, which is essentially sedentary and farming, and these other ones which were essentially using a livestock, pastoral modes of engagement, there was a constant to and fro in which China had to put much of its industry and energy into protecting this interior. This was a massive, massive hinterland area where they fought countless wars against nomadic groups. And so one of the arguments, and I mean the Great Wall is sort of, I don't know, like a solution to this, I guess, by just building a wall and cutting them off. And so one of the arguments is that China spent so much time engaging internally in trying to maintain its boundaries that it didn't have the capacity to focus elsewhere. Anyway, after this you don't really hear anything about China's involvement in Africa for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And then we start to see China and Africa. Africa starts becoming very important to China in the 20th century, and we're sort of going to leapfrog now from the Middle Ages to the 20th century. Okay, there we go. So, the modern aspect of China's engagement in Africa really takes off in the socialist period. There was like an example of one Qing dynasty. Qing was the last dynasty of China, one Qing dynasty consulate in Johannesburg, which looked after indentured laborers who came over during the early 20th century. But other than that, there's not much evidence. But the thing about socialism, which was really important with China's engagement in Africa, was the Cold War. And so when China became socialist, it had this idea of the Socialist International, the Communist International, and the idea was that all the people of the world who had been exploited and who were working and underclasses would unite through socialism and overthrow sort of capitalist aggressors. And so China, as it became socialism, had this from being quite an insulated and isolated kingdom, suddenly embraced this idea of international socialism. And this is a Chinese propaganda poster saying how Africans and Latin Americans and Chinese should embrace and overthrow American imperialism. So you can see here a definite, okay, it's been hundreds and hundreds of years before when China engaged with Africa, was sort of with this imperial encounter, although no colonialism. Whereas here you suddenly see it more on an equal footing, like we're all together. The thing as well which China used to leverage its influence in Africa was the idea that they were both victims of colonialism. Now, of course, China wasn't colonized in the way that Africa was, but it was subject to various forms of European aggression. I mean, the two famous episodes of the two opium wars with Britain at the turn of the century. Japan had colonized large parts of eastern China, and up where you were in the northeast, but in Manchuria. And of course, there were also all the European enclaves that had been set up in South China and Shanghai, and so forth. So while China had not been fully colonized, it saw itself as a victim of European and American imperialism, and it felt that this had a connection with Africa because they too had been victims of this aggression. It also gave China, in 19th century imperialism, China felt like it had been denied its proper place in the world. And